Please go ahead. This afternoon's conference call is now being recorded.
Thank you, Tim. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the PPSAI Working Group call on the 15th of April, 2014. On the call today, we have Justin Macy, Laura Jadid, James Bladell, McKaylee Nyland, Tatiana Christova, Christian Dawson, Steve Medelitz, Osvaldo Nuava, Darcy Southwell, Don Blumenthal, Libby Bainey, Paul McGrady, Roy Belise, Tom Lamb, Carlton Samuels, Graham Bunton, Griffin Barnett, David Heasley, Jim Bykoff, Kathy Kleiman, Frank Mekulik. We have apologies from Sarah Wild, Christina Rosette, and Amir Elsdar, as well as Joe Catapano. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Amy Bivens, Mike Zupke, and myself, Terry Agnew. I'd like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
I appreciate it. Thanks. Just jumping back to the right screen. Well, first, since I wasn't on the call last week, I just wanted to note in general, it's good to see some people that I had not met before. It's one of the best things, some might suggest one of the few good things about ICANN meetings. We live in this small world, and conference calls in Adobe, the chance actually put faces to lines in a chat room or email is really valuable. Why don't we jump right into the session? James, as offered, was drafted, however you want to put it, I wasn't there, to discuss the whole issue of DoD-TOD transfers. So I will step back and listen.
Thanks, Don. James speaking. Did you want me to just go ahead? Because I had difficulty hearing you there at the end.
Yeah, please. Might as well get started.
Okay. Oh, that's much better. Thanks. Okay, so this is James speaking for the transfer and for the transcript and thanks. Today, I volunteered to present an overview of how transfers work in GTLDs. Is in the context of discussing how transfers and other policies might interact with privacy proxy accreditation services. And in order to delve into those questions, I think it was determined that we needed a better synchronized understanding of how the transfers work. This slide, Jack, I would love for you guys to think that I just kind of, you know, banged this out here in the last week, but in fact it is from one of our IRTP PDPs. I think Marika and staff, Mary, can probably help me. This is going back now probably to late 2012. So it is a little dated. I will try to highlight any areas where I think that the information in the slide is, you know, perhaps been overtaken by events. But I think that I did go through it over the weekend, and it looks fairly fairly current. So I'll try to go through this quickly. I'll try to make it interesting. I'll try to leave ample time for Q&A, but certainly interrupt me if you feel like we're going too fast. So next slide, please. So here's the purpose of transfers. And in general, the transfers, while not the most exciting thing in the world, are critical to supporting a competitive marketplace. Because it allows registrants to leave and move their business to another service provider if they're unhappy, if they see a better price, or if they just want to, you know, want to change of scenery. Transfers of registrations are varied and implemented differently at different registrars. So the purpose of the transfer policy is to establish some standardization so that the different service providers can interoperate in a compatible manner. The transfers are often used in conjunction with a change of control. So that is where a domain name not only changes registrars, but also changes registrants, typically in the case where a domain name has been sold on an aftermarket, or perhaps, you know, in the enforcement of a UDRP or other type of decision like that. And that was something that this particular working group addressed as well. Next slide. So here's a couple of diagrams that are going to outline the sequence for a transfer when everything goes right. And it is meant to be broad brush strokes. I'm sure that registrar colleagues on the phone will point out a number of details that are sometimes implemented inconsistently, but in general, this is how the process works. The transfer process is initiated at the new registrar. So a registrant opens an account with a new registrar and says something along the lines of, I want to move my domain name to my new account and my new registrar. And the new registrar will usually provide instructions or walk them through the process, or even perhaps has a support team dedicated to this process. So the new registrar will essentially say, to start the process, make sure your names are unlocked and retrieve your auth info codes. Next slide. The new registrar also concurrently performs a WHOIS lookup to get the registrant of record, the email for the registrant and the admin email. The registrant and the admin contacts are collectively called the transfer contact. And this form of authorization for the transfer, which is required by the policy, is sent to the transfer contact. This is a critical part of essentially establishing the paper trail of authorization for the transfer. Next slide. The registrant unlocks the domain name, and in its current registrar says, send me the auth info code. The auth info code is a unique ID number. You can think of it as a password for the domain name or a key that is shared by the registrar and is on record at the registry. The registrant accepts the form of authorization, sends that and the auth info code back to the new registrar. The new registrar then contacts the registry and says, okay, I've got a completed and accepted form of authorization, and I have a valid auth info code, and then it sends that up to the GTLD registry and requests that the transfer of sponsorship of the domain name move to the new registrar. Next slide, please.
James?
Oops, sorry.
Steve's got his hand up there. Do you want to jump in?
Okay. Sorry, not paying attention to the queue. Jump in, Steve.
Yeah, I'm sorry. If you can, I'm trying to again figure out how this would fit in with the proxy service situation. So if you go back to your, I think it's your second slide on a pristine transfer. So it's that one I think. So that's the point. It seems to me at which the new registrar performs a WHOIS lookup. And in the case of a service, of a proxy service, they will have the contact information for the proxy service, basically. That will be the one to whom they send the form of authorization. So that, I think, is the point at which this system, it's hard to fit this system into the proxy service system because we have to assume that the service provider is going to communicate to the customer, who is what I would call the registrant here, or is that mistaken? Would the customer have to go first to the service provider and say, "Hey, I want you to initiate this process"? Since you're the
that's a good question, Steve. So, if I could take a swing at addressing that, Don.
Certainly.
Okay. Thank you. Essentially, the registrant icon in this scenario in the context of this PDP would be representing the privacy service. And the form of authorization and all communication from a new registrar would, in fact, be going to the service. However, I think as we noted from our previous presentations, a number of these services will generate a unique email. And that will be used for relay purposes for this type of communication, critical communication. However, as we discussed in our last call, a number of proxy services, because when they're in the role of the current registrar, will reject transfer requests as a security feature, and we'll ask registrants or their privacy proxy customers to deactivate the proxy service prior to initiating the transfer. So going all the way back to slide one. Does that help, Steve?
Yeah, I think it helps, especially because since we're on the question of what the rights and responsibilities of the service provider would be, I suppose this suggests that one responsibility is to cooperate in this transfer process. Obviously, that could take different routes. And in the case of a provider that generates this unique email address, then is that email address, is that immediately accessible to the customer, or is that simply a unique email address that's maintained by the service provider and the customer doesn't necessarily receive that?
Probably best described as an email alias that would be posted in Whois, and an automated relay would occur if, A, the service were structured to do that, and B, if the, in our case, we allow the registrar or the customer of the privacy proxy service to select what kinds of emails they will and will not receive. So if that were to fail, for example, then the transfer would not be considered authorized and it would be rejected, and I believe it times out after 5 days.
Okay, thank you.
Kathy?
Yeah, following up on Steve's question, good morning, everybody, and James, thank you for the presentation. This is very helpful. Following up on Steve's question, can we try two scenarios? One is if you're transferring within a proxy privacy service provider. So if I'm transferring to someone else in domains by proxy, I don't know if we want to pick a specific one, James, but does that require an unveiling or a publication of the information? And the other question would be, and I'm not sure it's just to James, how might we set up a system that doesn't require the relinquishing of the proxy privacy protections prior to a transfer between proxy privacy service providers? Is there a way that, as a working group, we can think about ways to keep that protection up? Two questions. Thank you.
So those are, I think, very key questions, Kathy. And I can tell you that for domains by proxy, and I believe this is true for Two Cows, and also I'm looking down the list, other registrars like Black Knight. In all cases, the privacy service must be deactivated prior to transfer, so that the domain name arrives at the new registrar with the customers, the privacy proxy customers' contact information, where they then would activate that registrar's privacy service. So you're correct. There is this period of exposure, and given that a number of services, and I know Domain Tools is represented on the call here, will archive Whois on a continuous basis, that means that is, even for that brief moment, potentially being captured by these services. So I think that would be an interesting, not just a policy question, but an interesting technical question to solve, is how can a domain name change registrars with the privacy services intact? And to my knowledge, that's not possible currently.
Great, thank you. I'd love to footnote that this is an area we should definitely be looking at. Don, if I might, this is a fascinating technical and policy area.
Can I make this even more complicated by noting that I think that some of that is an artifact of the thin Whois model in not having visibility to the other registrar's Whois data and perhaps having thick Whois universally implemented across all GTLDs might be, one way that registrars could begin to address that problem.
So we just ignore it for a few years and it'll go away, huh? Got a couple more people in the queue here. McKaylee?
Thanks, McKaylee speaking. James touched on an important thing. One of the key issues here is with respect to thin registries. In the case of a thick registry, you wouldn't need to rely solely on Whois to get back the details you need in order to do a transfer. In the case of thin Whois, it's the only thing you can rely on, plus it's also the only way you have of accessing a lot of the data. So hypothetically speaking, if you were to logically follow through what is possible and what isn't possible using EPP, one could, in theory, access the data needed to initiate transfers if the registry was thick. In the case of a thin one, you can't. You have to use Whois. And, of course, the problem is that while you could potentially do a transfer with privacy proxy in place, 9 times out of 10 it's going to fail. This is based on our experience. Plus, there's no way of knowing whether or not the email is actually functional. Thanks. Do you mind if I address Steve's thing on the chat? Because he's asking about the EPP thing here.
Oh no, actually, because I had a question here too. So perfect.
The EPP allows you to transfer data that isn't public. So if I as the gaining registrar of a domain, and I'm just talking about domains in general, but it doesn't matter if they're ccTLDs or gTLDs, because we're talking EPP as a protocol, not as an ICANN exclusive concept. Once I, as the gaining registrar, have a valid key, I should be able to access data that's not in the public realm. So I could potentially access extra data. Somebody who's more familiar with EPP might be able to give more concrete examples, but that's what I'm referring to. Whereas in thin Whois, the valid key is the auth info code, Kathy, yes. In thin registries, the registry does not have the contact details. It only has a minimal set of information, such as the domain create, domain expiry, and very little else. Thanks.
I appreciate that clarification. James, do you want to go ahead and handle the queue since it's...
Sure, I can do that. I see a number of other registrars want to weigh in on this, so Volker, please.
Yes, just two things about Kathy's question there about the reveal. It's a bit of a conundrum, as you said, James, and in our case, when we get requests from registrants that say, how can we turn off the Whois privacy when we want to transfer if we do not want to have our details in the Whois, is that we usually recommend to the registrants to use a throwaway email address for the underlying data and use the new privacy proxy services data already before initiating the transfer. So when we deactivate the service, the new data would already be in place. The registrant would then transfer that email, that domain name with the throwaway email address and the data, and then he would, at the new registrar, again update his Whois details. This, of course, will be made impossible once the waiting periods in that are coming out of IITPC are implemented, which will complicate things even further. But we've found no other workable solution at this time that allows the registrant to stay hidden during a domain transfer. Some registrants have tried transferring out domain names with the Whois privacy service intact. That means that that at the moment of the transfer, the email address is no longer working because we will not provide the forwarding service that they described a couple of sessions back, and we will file. I'll either file who is an accuracy complaint with ICANN right away when we get notice of that, or take other action against the incorrect WHOIS data, because basically it's our liability when we are in the WHOIS for a domain name that we cannot remove ourselves from the WHOIS at a moment's notice.
Thank you, Volker, and I think that's correct, and I think that currently is the case for other privacy proxy services. If we were to spot our contact data being used when a domain name that's sponsored by another registrar, that's usually a pretty good indicator that something is wrong, and we would take action against that domain name. Tim, you're up.
What I don't understand is why relay isn't an opportunity to perhaps implement a transfer without revealing data. You talk about using thick WHOIS, and I think that might have some merit to a point, but it relies a lot on then, you know, bringing registries into this process, you know, quite a bit further. And then I think, you know, that would be an even bigger debate. And I'm not even sure how many registries we have in this working group, but we'd want to make sure that we've got good representation so we can see what they think about, what it would increase in their responsibility as far as handling transfers. Relay, you know, the only reason Relay doesn't work is because nobody uses it for that purpose, but it certainly could. You know, if a proxy service receives a request, there's no reason why that couldn't be relayed on to the underlying beneficial user who can then reply in a particular way, and the proxy service relays that reply on to the requesting registrar. So certainly an opportunity in there to make that work. It just hasn't been done, but there isn't a reason why it couldn't be and somehow made to work. Now, it may not solve every situation, such as UDRPs, et cetera, but then I think, you know, that's a situation where, you know, it might be prudent to use the registries perhaps in the thick WHOIS setting a little bit more, you know, for that type of a thing. But for just normal transfers, it would seem to me that there's an opportunity to make Relay work appropriately for that. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, I think you're right. And it just occurred to me that Relay, in most cases, is a one-way transaction. There's no way for a registrant to respond from the Relay address that might be assigned to them from the service. So that, I mean, it's an implementation issue, but it seems to be the way that those systems are structured now. Steve, you're up next.
Yeah, thank you. This has been a very informative discussion. I appreciate everybody's contributions to it. So just picking up on Tim's point, then, it might be theoretically possible for this to be handled through Relay, but apparently no, or at least many proxy service providers that are affiliated with registrars are not doing it that way, and I can understand the business reason not to. But then it becomes, I mean, to some extent, it's a disclosure issue and making sure that registrants or customers are aware of this. But I appreciate his comment that it is theoretically possible, and maybe perhaps that's a best practice that one would want to encourage. I do want to come back to this issue of the extent to which thick WHOIS addresses the problem. I get it that there could be non-public information that's communicated through EPP, but my understanding is that even in a thick registry situation, what's the basis for assuming that the registry actually has the underlying contact information of a proxy registrant? In theory, even the registrar doesn't have that. It's their affiliated, or in some cases non-affiliated, proxy service provider who has that information. Or is that information routine in a thick registry environment? I'm not clear why that information would routinely be held by the registry. I agree that if it were, and if EPP could then be used to communicate that way, that would be that would solve the problem. But I guess I'm puzzled. Am I wrong in assuming that in my assumption that a thick registry would not ordinarily have the contact information of the proxy service provider customer?
Thanks, Steve. You're correct. The thick registry would not have the underlying contact information. The reason to introduce that, and I agree that it would not necessarily solve this issue that was originally raised by Kathy, but I think that it maybe turning that around and saying the fact that there are thin registries and that registrars, you know, even in transfers that don't involve privacy proxy services today, are relying on the veracity of the WHOIS information contained by the other registrar, I think that complicates this issue and necessitates why a registry or registrar would either lack a transfer request for a privacy domain name or not accept a request for a domain name to transfer in with another registrar's privacy proxy information. So it's possible that a combination of transitioning to a thick registry model and establishing some sort of a trust mechanism based on the idea of accredited proxy services might someday address those two issues, but I agree with you. It's not that we're counting on the registry to be a repository of the underlying privacy proxy information. It's more a question of do you have some third party information to confirm that it is a privacy service and who is, or are you just doing it blind? And I think in the current model for thin registries, you're doing it blind.
So it's partly a question of the level of confidence in the accuracy of the WHOIS data.
Is it me now? Since nobody seems to be managing the queue, or maybe I've just lost the line. Hello?
Hello.
No,
sorry,
here.
I just got bumped over onto mute. Sorry about that. Michele, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Just this thing about the reliability of the data in thick versus thin. I don't think this isn't really the issue, operationally speaking. Operationally speaking, the biggest issue as a gaining registrar we run into, it's not about what the data on the losing registrar side is. It's whether or not the losing registrar's who is server is actually serving anything, or that we can access it. So, I mean, if the losing registrar's WHOIS server is offline more than it's online, or has crazy-ass rate limits, which mean that one query and you get blacklisted, then it's very, very hard for us to do a transfer. Also, as well, technically speaking, WHOIS servers, like any other software, will fall over. I was informed by our technical team earlier today that ours was misbehaving yesterday for a couple of hours. This kind of thing happens, because in the case of a thin registry, it's not just what the data is. It's the actual, is there anything that you can access? And it's not simply an enforcement issue, because the problem is that a lot of the time it's, you know, the registrar themselves probably needs to sort their stuff out. I mean, personally, I couldn't give a damn about the enforcement. All I want to be able to do is transfer a domain between registrars. The other thing as well is with respect to data, underlying data, and all this reveal and relay thing is, what I was suggesting wasn't that data was available now, but that hypothetically it could be available. I mean, already at the moment the EPP keys are held at the registry level, they're obviously not going to be public. And there's no reason why you couldn't add other bits of data somewhere else. I'm not saying that the underlying registrant contact or anything is going to end up being pushed to a registry, but, you know, if, for example, let's say we were to go back to the kind of the operational contact points concept that was bandied about several years ago, you know, you could have an email address that would be available for transfers only or something. I mean, there's a lot of different possibilities there. I'm just saying that in a SIC registry, you have more options open to you. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. And Kathy, you're next, and then we should probably address some of the conversation going on in the queue.
Do you want me to wait while you're doing that, James?
Well, let's see here. I want to see if there's anything that we're catching in the chat. Don, maybe if you could review that while Kathy's speaking, and then let us know what we need to address there.
Yeah, I was just scrolling back up.
So I was wondering if the valid key that Michele was talking about, or the auth information code that you were talking about, James, which I understand to be the same thing, might provide a way through some of the discussions that we're talking about. Because if a registrant under proxy privacy, and I'm just throwing this out there because I don't know these systems nearly as well as you do, but if the registrar provides the auth info code to a proxy privacy service provider that then passes it on to its registrant, and then the registrant, even though they're under proxy privacy, is able to produce that code to enable and facilitate the transfer, can the code itself be used as the proof of a valid request for the transfer? Because the registrant wouldn't have it if it hadn't passed through kind of a trusted network from the registrar to the proxy privacy service provider to the registrant. Can the code itself be the authenticity?
Thanks, Kathy. Interesting question. And this is something that touches on a little bit something that's currently being discussed in IRTPD, which is whether or not the auth info code has effectively replaced any other types of authorization and has become sort of the de facto transfer authorization for domain name in all cases. And I think that's, without going into the weeks of discussions on that issue, the working group is basically coming down on the idea that it has become that in most situations. However, there are certainly enough edge cases and situations where a customer's registrar account may have been compromised to prevent us from kind of endorsing that auth info code as a general purpose transfer key. So I think, I'm not sure if that directly addresses your question. I think, could it be used or further employed to establish some degree of trust between a new registrar and a privacy proxy service customer from another registrar with whom they had no relationship? I think that's possible, but now I'm channeling Mikey O'Connor, who likes to point out that the auth info code right now is overloaded and is used to check or to authenticate the registrant on just so many different types of transactions that, he considers it to be an overloaded piece of data. But it is something interesting, and I think that any approach that would eventually allow a domain name to transfer while maintaining private information would probably make use of that code in the way that you described it.
And perhaps with some additional protections built around it to prevent some of the edge situations that are creating problems now, which I don't fully understand, but I recognize they're there.
Sure, why not? I mean, these are, I think, good points, but they are a bit speculative in that, the transfer process that is laid out in the slides is actually more of a model in reality, and I think the other registrars will weigh in. It actually frequently encounters problems, not the least of which is what Michele was raising, which is, not having access to the other registrars who have data, and the whole thing breaks on the first step. So, we'll jump to Tim next.
Thank you.
Yeah, and let's move on in the slide deck after Tim.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that or point out that there really isn't any 100% secure way to do transfers. Even the way we're doing it now, we have issues. And I'm not sure that it necessarily has to do with that by not relying on the off code alone, that we're actually, you know, have diminished transfers, false transfers or whatever, that much. So I guess I would agree with Kathy that what we should do instead is take those identified edge cases and see if those aren't things that could be dealt with. And if, you know, if we see that that's a possibility, then maybe this is one of the potential recommendations we could make, even though I realize it would probably require, you know, some work with the transfer process policy down the road.
Thanks, Tim. Is that an old hand, Kathy? Or did you want to respond?
I apologize, that's an old hand.
Okay. Okay, so returning back to the slide deck, thanks, Don, for putting us back on track. And I actually think we're almost done. I think this is where we left off here. So once the form of authorization and the auth info code is presented to the new registrar, it is relayed to the registry, and the new registrar asks the registry to transfer sponsorship of the domain name. Next slide. The registry takes a look, everything checks out. It notifies the current registrar, the registrar of record, that the domain name is transferring away. In some cases, this may be the current registrar's first indication that the registrant is that they are losing this particular customer. The transfer it does not occur right away. The current registrar has the ability to NAT or block or object to the transfer, which they can do within 5 days. After 5 days, however, the default timeout process is that the transfer would proceed. Next slide, please. Here are just a couple of reasons why this process might not work or may deviate from the model that we were just discussing. If the FOA is not accepted, if the domain name is locked, if the auth info code is invalid, or if the losing registrar rejects the transfer. Next slide. The losing registrar can't just reject transfers for whatever reason it likes. It has to do so based on some clear justification for why it denied the transfers. These are called reasons for denial. And this, I think, has been updated since November 2011, so apologies for that. This is probably one of those slides that's a little dated. But as you can see here, there have to be reasons for this rejection of a transfer. Other registrars certainly are not shy about reporting. Registrars are not shy about reporting each other to ICANN compliance if they feel a transfer has been rejected for insufficient cause. And compliance will routinely ask registrars why they rejected a particular transfer and ask to see documentation of one of these events. Next slide, please.
Actually, I think that's it, James.
Okay, great. So as a service. A privacy proxy service will essentially, it's not necessarily rejecting the transfer at the registrar level. The service itself is, if we can go back one slide, the service itself is rejecting the FOA. So that is where the privacy proxy service is saying, no, I do not authorize this transfer as the registrant of this domain name. To Kathy's point, yes, that means that privacy services would need to be removed prior to initiating a transfer. At least that's how the industry solves this issue today. To another point, I think that, you know, it is, at least amongst our customers and our service, and I'm sure other registrars would agree, that the privacy service provides an extra layer of security against unauthorized transfers, because you essentially, it's another form of lock that someone who is attempting to hijack or steal a domain name and move it to a new registrar would not have access to the privacy service and be able to cancel that service to allow the transfer to proceed. So it is another hurdle that a bad guy would have to go through in order to hijack a domain name. So that was it. I think that we covered a lot of the meat of this issue in our discussions in some of the earlier slides, but would be happy to address any other questions, or I'll be looking to my registrar colleagues on the call if they want to weigh in on these issues as well.
Tell you what, why don't we move on? Oh, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Steve Michel. I appreciate this presentation and all the input from the other registrars on the call, too. I mean, my sense is that we kind of have two ways we could go here. One is kind of the descriptive way, based on the world as it is now, and there, in terms of rights and responsibilities of service providers, it seems as though it's basically a disclosure requirement. So to make sure that registrants or their customers are aware that in order to effect a transfer to a different registrar, you will generally need to step out of the service. That is also a protection against unauthorized transfer, but it also is an impediment to an authorized transfer. That's one route. The other route is more prescriptive. If we want to say that as a minimum accreditation standard, the service providers should do what most of them are not now doing, which is what I was having the dialogue with Tim about in the chat. You know, should they be required to cooperate to facilitate a transfer, whether it's through relay, as he suggests, or in some other way, to facilitate a transfer if their customer wants it? So I think that's kind of, at least based on what I've heard today, it sounds as though we would have to choose whether to take a descriptive approach in these minimum standards or a more prescriptive approach that says in order to be accredited, you actually have to do things differently than most services are doing them today. I don't know, I'd be interested in others' reactions to that, but that just struck me that that's a little bit of a fork in the road that we're looking at here, as far as rights and statements of rights and responsibilities for service providers. Thank you.
Don, did you want me to respond? Sure, and I think other registrars, and I haven't been following the chat, may have already weighed in on this. Steve, I think that you correctly identify the choice or the fork in the road, as you put it. My concern, just my initial reaction without having really put a whole lot of thought into how to address this problem, is that if we were to choose the fork that says, you know, fix this problem, registrars, I think that we might be going down an interesting and I'm trying to be careful here, but a possibly technologically unworkable situation. And my concern is just that, addressing that problem, if someone were to be able to reliably address that problem, I think it would be pretty amazing and would have, in fact, I think would have invented some really interesting and new-to-world type processes and technologies. And so I think we have to be careful that we don't, compel service providers to do that in policy. I think that that's my only concern, is that we would, require service providers to solve a problem that no one has yet to date. But I think it's an interesting idea, and I think you have accurately captured the choice that we would have to make as a working group.
Okay, I made one exception. Why don't we call on Stephanie, and then we'll at least get something done on category B question three. Stephanie? Stephanie? Stephanie, we're not hearing you.
Dawn, just move on if she's not on the call.
Yeah, I was just gonna say why don't we move on if you could just type what you have to say and we'll move on to the document.
Dawn, sorry, I'm having trouble sharing the second document. So just if you just give us a couple of minutes here.
Okay. Maybe Stephanie will be back.
Dawn, this is Steve Metalitz. If we're in a bit of a pause here to get another document up, there are these questions on the right-hand side of the screen, and I would be interested in response, James or others' responses to them. Like the first question, this is in the expiration renewal situation rather than a transfer situation, but it seems as though it raises the same concern. Registrars must notify the registered name holder of the expiration at least 2 times. So that would mean that the registrar is sending it to the service provider. So then the question is, should it be a requirement for the service provider to notify its customer that, you know, your registration is about to expire? I just wonder what is the normal practice today, and is this something that raises the same kinds of issues that we just talked about?
Hello?
Yes?
Who's yelling at their phone?
That's Stephanie.
That would be Stephanie. I just managed to get my mic working. Sorry to interrupt, Steve. I didn't mean to. I didn't think it would work.
I finished asking my question, so.
Jolly good. Well, I typed out my question, but basically, when you say that Mikey is concerned about what's being loaded on that authorization code, I too am concerned. Can someone explain to me what is loaded on that auth code? Because clearly, and we've been working in EWG about all of this kind of stuff, if there's too much loaded on there and it creates a weak point where the bad guys can do something, then that's a problem, right? This is the non-geek here talking.
Well, does a geek or quasi-geek want to answer that? Kelly?
Oh, sorry. I thought somebody was going to speak to Stephanie's point.
I saw your hand up. I thought maybe.
Oh yeah. Well, I was reacting to Mr. Metalitz, because I feel somebody has to. A lot of the stuff around notifications and how registrants, account holders, etc. are notified with respect to upcoming expiries and everything was discussed to death during the post-expiry domain name recovery working group. I believe there are several survivors of that PDP on this call. I'd have to check transcripts, which I'm not going to do because I really don't have the time or the energy. But I'm sure we did look at privacy proxy stuff. I mean, like, from a very practical point of view, a lot of us, and I'm not speaking for all registrars here, we send billing notices, in other words, renewal notices, to the billing contact detail we have on our internal billing system. And what the details I have for my clients and what my clients publish and what we publish for our clients are very, very different. So that's not really an issue. So if, for example, a domain name that's held that is on, that might be behind privacy or proxy, with ourselves, I'm not going to be relying on Whois details to be sending them renewal notices. Thanks.
Tim, did you have a response to Stephanie's question?
Yes, I did. Tim, again.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, I don't know about loading what all is trying to be loaded onto the auth code. I don't think anyone suggested the auth code be used for anything other than transfers. You know, there was some discussion about possibly, you know, uploading or transferring additional information in addition to the auth code to FIC registries. So there was some discussion of that. But I think the auth code has a specific purpose, and I agree. I think that the reasons or the purposes it's used for should be minimal, so that you know, there isn't the registrant doesn't have to keep this code memorized or known or written down on something for forever and ever because they have to use it every time they turn around. So I think it should be used strictly for transfers. And then just a quick note about Steve's question about that first question on the right, because it's about renewals, actually. And I was just going to mention what McKaylee did there, that that it may not be that simple to just say, well, we're going to require the PP provider to notify its beneficial user, because at many registrars, they have their customer information is separate from Whois information, and when they notify registrants of renewal, often they'll be notifying both. However, I don't think there's any reason why you couldn't require the proxy privacy provider, once notified by the registrar, to notify via whatever method it has. You know, we have this discussion coming up about relay. Maybe I'm beginning to wonder if we're going to find out that most PP providers never implemented Relay. I would find it hard to believe. And so there must be some mechanism in place for PP providers to contact or have discourse with or whatever with their underlying users. So while I understand McKaylee's point to some degree, I also think that I guess I'm beginning to wonder why PP providers can't communicate with their underlying user and find out and get things back, like asking them, oh, we got a transfer request, here's the information, do you want this to go through? And they respond. Seems like a simple thing to me. So if it's more complicated, there are problems in that. Instead of just saying there is, I'd like to understand the specifics of what the problems or the roadblocks are, because they might be things we could overcome. Thanks.
Appreciate it. We have 5 minutes to go. Note to self, next time I say let's move on, stick to my determination. At this point, let's just continue this discussion. We will get to this document again next week. Stephanie and then James.
I think Stephanie might be back on mute.
Okay. James, you want to jump in?
Yes, and actually my question was, or my comment was to address Stephanie's question, and I think Tim covered it mostly, but just wanted to add that, you know, it certainly seems that there could be, first of all, for overloading off info codes, we've had recommendations through other or proposed recommendations for other PDPs that auth info codes be used for things such as inter-registrar transfers, locking and unlocking domain names, updating or verifying Whois details, and it was just kind of getting to this, you know, as Tim said, where it was this kind of required password in order to conduct any sort of transaction related to your domain name, including changing name servers, and it was becoming a universal key, and that it would become then therefore vulnerable to being compromised. So that's to address Stephanie's question. But I think Tim has the actual has captured the important element or takeaway from this. whether we're talking about transfers or whether we're talking about expiry notices, that there should be some types or categories of email communications, not only from, let's say, law enforcement or claims of, abuse, but also from the sponsoring registrar that a privacy service must relay to its underlying customer, and that it should not have the discretion to either block or withhold those messages. And I think that's kind of where, in general, where this is trending. And I think if there are services that aren't doing that, I think we need to understand why, because I don't know that there is a compelling reason why they shouldn't be required to relay certain critical domain critical messages. Thanks.
Michele?
Thanks, Don. Just picking up on something from James, James's point. One of the reasons why people sign up for proxy privacy services is so that they don't get emails. This is something that Stephanie, myself, and Carlton have been, what's the polite way of describing this, vigorously discussing within the EWG over the last couple of months. But from the registrar, yes. Sorry, okay, so James put in the chat there, but from the registrar. So I think if you worded it along the lines of, you know, the proxy privacy service would need to relay all messages from the from their registrar, then yeah, that's absolutely fine. Just a kind of a blanket must relay everything concept would be one of the reasons why people didn't want the stuff in the first place. I did a check on a system earlier today just to see the amount of emails being directed at domain names using a particular privacy service. And from a very small sampling, totally unscientific, of a snapshot of, a week on a small number of domains, I'd say 90%+ were coming from mail servers that were black-holed and blacklisted by Spamhaus. So, the volume of actual legitimate email that could potentially be going to those domains is probably negligible. Thanks.
I appreciate that, Michele. Interesting. Let's just start to wrap up here. It wasn't quite what we had in mind, but this discussion has been outstanding. For substance, for education, whatever term you want to use, I really appreciate your picking up, leading it, maybe getting into more than you expected, James, but it's going to be very helpful as we go along. We will revisit this question next week, the one we plan to talk to today, hopefully move on to the next. Please take some time in the email list to follow up on any issues that came up today that you still need clarification on. The list has been a little quiet recently. Probably it for me to complain about less email, but it really is useful sometimes. Until then, we will talk to you all next week.
Thanks, Don.
Good night.
Thanks, Don.
Recording.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, James.